Well, you know, I was really at a loss to know how to introduce you because I've introduced you probably 4 or 5 times now on these calls, and I felt like I was almost running out of things to say. I've just, you know, said so much about you. But so I was trying to think about what would be the one word that I could think of that would best describe what you do for homeopathy and, you know, your overall contributions. And really that word is genius. And I mean that with all sincerity. And I want everyone on the call who has the opportunity to be on this call tonight to really understand that Will is really a genius in homeopathy. He is one of the greatest scholars we have. He is an amazingly gifted communicator and educator, and he's a tremendous clinician, a tremendous practitioner. So he really embodies the qualities that are necessary to be one of our guiding lights. And I know that in 150 years, we'll be talking about Dr. Will Taylor the way we talk about somebody like Farrington or Dunham or Lippe. So with that brief introduction, I just want to thank you again, Will, for joining us. It's so generous on your part to do so many of these calls.
God, now I got to be careful to say something intelligent, Kim. Can we do one of these once a week? If you...
All righty. So, Will, thank you again, really. I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Oh, this is fun, Kim.
It'll be great.
This is fun, everyone.
So we had talked that tonight we were going to be doing talking about the Bunninghausen approach. And so I thought perhaps just briefly you could tell us what are the major features that distinguish Bunninghausen's approach to case analysis. What makes it really unique or different?
Well, there are a couple, and I think these really owe to Bunninghausen's genius and what he brought to the profession. And if I can backtrack a little bit, I think contributed not so much as a technique or a methodology, but as a kind of overriding principles that that don't need to be confined to a, quote, Bunninghausen method, unquote, but that trickle out and affect everything that we do. And this was his incredible tact for organization. You know, organized elegantly, not in a desperate arsenicum kind of way or in an obsessive Carson Nelson kind of way, but in a really functional kind of way. So he, I think the two major things that distinguish it are attention to making sure that we're always looking at a complete totality. And I think Bunninghausen did better than anybody in our history, a really good job of defining what the totality of symptoms really means. You know, it's not just the sum total of everything, but it's a coherent coherent construct that arises out of appreciation of small parts, and he did a really nice job of defining what these small parts are and how they lock together into a coherent larger picture. So one of the aspects of the approach is a very intentional paying attention to making sure that we have all of the parts of a complete totality covered in the analysis. And then the second is a piece that we'll probably get into a little bit more, but is generalizing modalities and sensations so that in really a manner that makes up for deficiencies in our knowledge. We all know that our provings are not complete, and you know, people get into talking about how contemporary provings are imperfect and not complete, but this is nothing new. I mean, when we go back and read them. And so he developed these approaches to kind of cover over some of the gaps in our knowledge, but by instead of looking at modalities and sensations as specific local symptoms, of generalizing them to the whole person. So I think those are the two most essential pieces.
You know, talking about this idea of generalization, I know for a lot of people that there's some confusion about it because I know even Herring and Kent were very critical of Bunninghausen's idea of this, this generalization process. And I know one of the examples that they gave is the idea that arsenicum, you know, if you generalized its body temperatures, it really wouldn't work because they're generally chilly and better warmth, but they've got that famous keynote symptom of head pain ameliorated by cold applications. So could you elaborate a little bit about that confusion or what that whole situation is about?
Yeah, and this is one of those things that's been batted about as a, quote, controversy within homeopathy over hundreds of years. You know, Herring weighed in on this and criticized Bunninghausen for generalizing these modalities, and Kent basically parroted Herring on the topic, as he often did. and others have defended this approach and so on. And I think one of the most important things to realize is that Benninghausen never proposed that we impose these generalizations on our materia medica. So he never proposed that when we write about arsenicum, we say amelioration by cold as a general symptom. He said, no, you know, keep it there, that it's generally chilly, generally worse from cold, but very specifically the headache is ameliorated by cold applications. But in the repertory, this is a different story. He said the goal of the repertory is it's to go fishing with. You know, it's like a fishnet. We want to drag it through the water, and we don't want to miss the fish that we need to end up with. And so we might need to cast it a little bit broader than what we've recorded in the Materia Medica for remedies. So let's put in the general symptom ameliorated by cold applications, and let's put arsenicum in there, because we've got this patient, and you know, they're never going to show the full, complete arsenicum picture like in the textbook, but maybe they've got this headache better with cold, and we don't want to miss arsenicum in that case. And for that matter, we've recorded this symptom, the headache ameliorated by cold, but maybe there's something else. You know, maybe if we, you know, arsenicum's been studied pretty thoroughly, but a lot of our remedies haven't. There might be another symptom ameliorated by cold that just has not been observed in approving or yet confirmed in a clinical setting. And we would lose it in our analysis if we didn't cast our net this broadly. So this is a modification, that this generalization of modalities, the generalization of sensations, is something intended for the repertory, and not to rewrite the materia medica in this manner.
Very interesting. Can we just go a little bit further with this and kind of, cause
sure.
I know that some people may not be that familiar with the Benninghausen repertories.
Yeah.
Like, for example, in Kent's repertory, cold air is mentioned as a modality in 264 different rubrics, and many of them are very specific, like head pain, forehead, eyes above, cold air aggravates boring pain. Whereas in the Benninghausen Therapeutic Pocketbook, which is the 1846 repertory from Benninghausen, it only appears in six rubrics, and they're all generally broad in scope, like change of general state, aggravation, cold air from. So I think the question for me and maybe other people as well is, why would you want to rely on a repertory that has so little detail like that?
Yeah, well, this is a very good question. And I think, you know, I think some very careful investigation into what kind of detail do we really want and is really useful for us. And I think sometimes we get carried away with what we feel is a need for detail. You know, often I have students who will give me a repertorization, and in it are maybe 5 or 10 complex rubrics, like the one you just mentioned on headache, forehead, lancinating pain, cold ameliorates, or whatever. And when you look at that rubric, you realize it's very complicated. There are several thoughts in it. There's several issues. And sometimes that rubric fits our case like a glove, and it's very central to our case. And so a detailed rubric like that can sometimes be extremely helpful. We have this very specific description. Boom, there it is in our rubric. And it's the most important aspect of the case. It's a central aspect of the case. But other times we might have someone who, his headache is kind of sharp. It's not clear whether we want to call it lancinating or stitching or maybe just a sharp ache. And does it really belong in that description or not? So, you know, maybe that rubric's a little too specific for our use. And if we rely on it, maybe we lose the remedy we need. And so at times like this, we want to cast our net a little broader instead of using so much detail. I think as homeopaths, we can always appreciate that more is not always better. You know, sometimes less is better. Sometimes a little less detail, casting the net a little broader, might include our remedy in the results, whereas if we're too specific, we're going to lose it. The goal of a repertorization is never to choose a remedy on a numerical basis. It's never to say, this is the highest scoring remedy, it's the one we're going to use. It's always to give us a reading list, maybe 10 remedies that we can reflect on and read about and then match. And if we're too specific with all of our rubrics, we're going to often miss this. And this was Benninghausen's intent. He did these repertorizations with very broad rubrics, usually each of them holding a lot of remedies in them. But what would bring out the leading remedies for him wasn't so much the specificity in each rubric, but the concomitance of them all together. In other words, we were saying, okay, we've got this modality, we've got this sensation covered in another rubric, we've made sure to cover the locality in the third, and any unusually accompanying symptoms, concomitant symptoms, such as, you know, excessive urination during headache, which is very, you know, you say, well, why is that there? And so here we've defined our remedy not so much with any one specific rubric, but with this collection of rubrics all colliding and covering our totality well. And to do this, use these broader rubrics. I go back and forth, and I find it really helpful. In fact, I'm really thrilled in the Synthesis 9.1. Now a lot of, you know, Benninghausen's rubrics have been incorporated. So you can choose to use, you know, out of the same repertory, these broader sweeping symptoms that generalize. And maybe if it's very appropriate in a case, you have a very specific, more closely defined rubric that comes out of the Kentian tradition that you want to add into that analysis and combine these in that way.
Well, you know, I know that having spoken to different people in the community, home Catholic community, who use the Boninghausen approach, some of them have told me that they find it particularly useful in certain types of cases. Like, I know, for example, the veterinarians oftentimes really like the Boninghausen-type repertories.
Mm-hmm.
And also I know that in India during epidemics or, you know, outbreaks of fever, they really like to use the therapeutic pocketbook. Have you found that the Boninghausen methodology works better in certain types of cases or when you have certain types of symptoms relative to other symptoms? Or what is your experience with this?
Well, that might be the case. I think that it's an approach that's broad enough that can be adapted to any of the cases we deal with. Clearly, it slides itself really easily into some. For example, you mentioned the fever. Benninghausen really knew his fevers. He actually wrote a repertory of fever, you know, so there's a lot of information there. And I think it's most useful if you're familiar with that vocabulary, you know, if you know what the vocabulary means, if you're familiar with the different components of fever and types and stages, it can be really, really handy. That's something that isn't often in our experience as much as practitioners today. It's certainly great for pediatric cases, for veterinary cases, because sometimes in these cases we don't have as much richness or detail in each symptom as we might like. You know, these subjects can't talk to us as readily. And so we're left with broader sweeping symptoms and have to rely more on assembling a totality where each symptom might carry a little bit less detail than we would like in most of our cases. So it's a really handy approach in those cases. When I first started using it, I typically would use Benninghausen's approach for my acutes, you know, where there are a lot of physical particulars. There's a good locality in the case, a good physical locality in the case, and so on. Because at first glance, it lends itself best to that, and I got comfortable using it that way. But then I've extended out beyond quite a bit, and I think that really isn't a real limitation to the approach.
I know that Lucas Shepper has told me pretty much the same thing you just said, which is that he started using it with acutes, and then he basically has extended it out, and he pretty much uses it on in almost any case that he uses. I know that even when he went to Sri Lanka, that was pretty much the only repertory he used. So, Will, I wanted to ask you some questions about the Boninghausen Therapeutic Pocketbook, which is the very famous 1846 repertory that Boninghausen wrote. But before I did that, I just wanted to ask you if you could give us some clarification, because there's a little bit of confusion out there about the Boninghausen repertory, and there's as you know, there's four different repertories which have Boninghausen's name associated with it.
Right.
There's the earlier ones from the 1830s, the repertory of medicines which are Soric and the repertory of medicines which are non-Soric, which are also now, I guess, known as the alphabetical repertories. And then there's the 1846 Therapeutic Pocketbook, and then there's the later, early 20th century Bozier-Boninghausen repertory.
Right.
I just thought perhaps you could just kind of tell us what is your experience of these different repertories? Do you use them all? What is the advantages, disadvantages? What insights can you share with regard to these different books?
Well, I've played with them all. The Therapeutic Vodka book actually is a bit more condensed than his earlier repertories, and I think it's the culmination of his thought of pulling in this idea of organizing symptoms. You know, when Hahnemann developed the first repertory, it was in Latin for one thing, but the symptoms were all complex. You know, it was head pain over the left eye, better with cold while swimming or whatever. And one of the problems with that repertory is nobody knew where to find rubrics in it, other than the guy who wrote it. You know, because well, do you look up swimming, or do you look up left eye, or do you look up, you know, how is it organized?
Sure, without computers, it was impossible to find what you were looking
for. Oh, man, can you imagine what Hahnemann would do with a laptop?
I know.
Oh, man, the guy would have wet his pants. He would have been so excited. Oh, or herring.
I know, really.
Oh, my God, herring would have just... He'd been like Mr. Toad when he saw that motor car. And instead of poot, and he just been... Oh, my God. So it was really Benninghausen's brilliance that said, well, let's break these symptoms down into component parts and just list them as component parts and not really reassemble them into complex symptoms. Let's leave just the component parts in the repertory. And the pocketbook was the kind of culmination of that thought. And that's the one I've spent most of my time with. What Bossier did, you know, Bossier was probably the principal proponent of Benninghausen's approaches in the West. Yet he was under some pressure from, you know, the folks, the Herrings and the Kants, who said, you know, when you generalize these modalities, you lose detail. You know, when you say Arsenicum's better cold applications, you're losing the specific detail, but it's their headache that's better cold applications. And so he bowed to that, and he created a compromise in the Bossier-Benninghausen repertory, where he threw in all of the, in addition to the general symptoms of, the generalized symptoms of Benninghausen, he threw in these more specific local modalities and local sensations. That's actually, it's a very interesting repertory. It kind of sits halfway in between Kant's and Benninghausen's. And, it's one that, when I first started using it, I wasn't quite sure. I used it just like I used Kant's, and it was a little confusing to figure out how to make sense of it. So you kind of need to go into it with a knowledge of the philosophy and approach. By the way, there's a wonderful little book by Desai, D-E-S-A-I, and it's called, I think, How to Find the Simillabum Using the Bossier-Benninghausen Repertory. And it's really focused on that text, although everything in it is applicable to using the pocketbook as well. That's a nice little guide to help you use the Bossier repertory as well. I think, you know, the real purists these days, who, you know, the Benninghausenites, are really emphasizing the use of the pocketbook. You know, Gipser and Dimitriadis and
sure.
And these folks. There's some use within that Benninghausenite community of the Bossier-Benninghausen repertory as well.
Mm.
But again, it's a bit of a hybrid between the approach of Kant, which uses these more locally defined symptoms, and the approach of Benninghausen, which uses the more generalized symptoms.
So, Will, getting back to the Benninghausen Therapeutic Pocketbook, which is the one that I really like as well, and I have more familiarity with, you know, for a lot of people, they look at it, and they look at the mind section, and they notice that there's only 36 rubrics in total in the whole mind section, and it's all really general stuff like seriousness or cheerfulness or irritability or mildness. And even some of the people you just mentioned, like Gipser or George Dimitriadis,
yeah.
I mean, these guys don't put any attention on the mind symptoms at all. So what's up with that? Do they not believe that the mind symptoms are important, or how do they take those into consideration when they're looking at a case, or how does this...
Well, I'm going to stick my foot in my mouth for a minute here and realize that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you that although those people that you quote, those contemporaries that you quote, will say that the mind symptoms are not important in this approach, I can feel Benninghausen roll over in his grave whenever that statement is made. I don't think Benninghausen departed at all from Hahnemann's, you know, what is it, aphorisms 210 through 213, where Hahnemann goes on and he says, you know, the only thing I can tell you about mental diseases as opposed to so-called somatic diseases is that all so-called somatic diseases also are mental-emotional, and all so-called mental-emotional are also somatic. And
sure.
And in fact, the mental-emotional symptoms often hold sway over the case because they're so highly characterizing. I don't hear anywhere where Benninghausen took issue with that. What he did struggle with was this. He knew how to break down a physical symptom into some definable parts so that he could list these in the repertory. So, you know, he had, in this proving a cholecystitis, you find abdominal pain that's cutting and griping in character, that's better with firm pressure. So he says, okay, let's break that down into locality, abdomen, or even more specifically, hollow viscus, okay? You know, uterus and or large bowel, okay? So that's locality. And then sensation, cutting, griping, pain, okay? And modality, better with firm pressure. And so he put cholecystitis in those three parts of the repertory. One has to do with locality, one with sensation, one with the modality. Now, when it comes to mental-emotional symptoms, he didn't know how to do that. What categories am I going to break these down in? And so he didn't know how to create a mind section of the repertory that was comparable to what he did with the somatic section. And so all he did was he put in these very general symptoms, but he gave very specific instructions. He didn't say ignore the mind. He said, after you've got some leading remedies in your repertorization, those that fit these somatic symptoms of the case, now you have to go to the proving and read the provings in detail and match the mental-emotional symptoms to the proving. You know, this is different from Kent. Kent said match the mental-emotional symptoms first. I don't think this had anything to do with importance or priority for Benninghausen. It had to do with his ability to create a repertory for the mind section. Now, how many of you guys out there can find everything you need in the mind section of Kent's repertory? It's a rhetorical question, really, isn't it? I mean, how do you find something in the mind section? Kent put this mind section together. Oh, it was brilliant. I'm not criticizing the man. He was brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. But can you find anything in there? It's all alphabetical. So you have to, if you really want to be adept with the mind section of the repertory, you need to have a brain like Farouk Master and dedication like Eddie Thielen's, right? You know, you have to sit down on the toilet for 3 hours every day and read this whole section and you know, until you start to remember it. Because, you know, fastidious, that's under F. Conscientious about trifles, that's under C. Rest cannot when things are not in their proper place, that's under R. Well, these three things, they have a lot to do with each other. They ought to be grouped together, don't you think? And here they are in three whole different places of the repertory. But how do you group them? You know, and it took something like computer technology and what Frederic is doing with synthesis now with the concepts, files, and so on to begin grouping these things into some reasonable kind of way. Benninghausen couldn't figure out how to do it and what dimensions of mind symptoms there should be. By the way, this is one of my favorite seminars, is the characterizing dimensions of a mental-emotional symptom. So this was a matter of how to organize. It wasn't a matter of are they important or not. And I think that some of these contemporary Benninghausenites who look at this and conclude that since Benninghausen paid so little attention to the mind symptoms in the repertory, it must mean that he devalued them, didn't think they were important. I think that that's totally, I think they're totally out to lunch on this. So, but that's me being outspoken. Yeah. We'll let them argue it back. You still there? Did I lose you, Kim? The line's silent, so either I offended Kim and he hung up on me, or I've been disconnected. So.
Will, can you hear me?
Oh, are you there again?
Yeah, my phone died. I'm sorry about
that. Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Okay, I was just doing a little dialogue on how I must have pissed you off with what I just said.
It's the first time I've ever hung up on one of these interviews. So I guess I was just
concluding for your ears that I think this idea that the mind symptoms aren't important is misguided. I think it's a misinterpretation of what Benninghausen did with this section.
Can you hear me now, Will?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about, well, I have a personal question, actually, which is about the, you know, the Benninghausen Latin hexameter, quis quid, cure ubi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know you know that very well. I wanted to see if you could just share a little bit about that, because I think it's so interesting and such a critical part of Benninghausen's development of his ideas. But I was curious, just as a personal aside, why is it called a hexameter when there's only seven of them? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't know.
Does anybody know the answer?
I didn't count.
Anyway, I've asked a lot of people. Nobody seems to know the answer to that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, that was a great article. You know, in our literature, there are these gems, you know, and they're kind of hidden and spread around. Like there's Kent's lecture on the second prescription. And there's that little article, The Medical Observer, that that nobody ever reads because it's just an introduction to the Materia Medica Pura, you know. And you know, the little things sprinkled around. And this is one of those. It's collected in Benninghausen's Lesser Writings. But it's a contribution. What's a contribution to the...
Oh, yeah, I could look it up. It's actually on the Whole Health Net website.
On the characterizing dimension of symptoms.
Right.
So this is a great article. You know, the way it evolved was at an international congress in Belgium. Benninghausen stood up and he said, I'm going to give a cash prize. He's a very wealthy man. He said, I'm going to give a large cash prize to the individual who, prior to the next annual meeting, writes a monograph on the characterizing value of symptoms. What makes a symptom characterizing and what doesn't? How, you know, what's the nature of characterizing value? And nobody took him up on it. And so the next seminar rolled around and he stood up and he said, well, I guess it's incumbent on me to collect my own prize and presented this article, presented this paper, and it's just beautiful. And he went back and he took this old hexameter, or what would it be? If there's seven, it would be what? It would be a heptameter? Heptameter? And, you know, it's basically the what's now the who, what, why, when, where, et cetera, of journalism. But what he pulled was this little Latin mnemonic that was used by monks to judge the severity of a sin, you know. And he said, well, let's use this to characterize a symptom. It's just a beautiful article to read, and it's one that I periodically go back and reread it because, you know, it's rich. You always find something new in it.
It really does.
It's up on the Whole Health Now website, isn't it?
It is up on the Whole Health Now website, and it is worth reading for sure.
I agree.
So, Will, you know, I have a copy of Alan's translation of the Therapeutic Pocketbook, and in the back is a section called Benninghausen's Concordances.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us a little bit about what these concordances are and what is their purpose? How could we use them? I know for a lot of people they're kind of this mysterious thing at the end of the book that they don't really know what to do with. So
yeah, this is one of the best collections of, quote, related remedies, unquote, that exists in the literature. And I understand that it probably derives from two sources. One was Benninghausen's encyclopedic knowledge of Materia Medica. And his knowledge was encyclopedic because, you know, of writing Materia Medicas, of writing the repertory, and of participating in provings himself. So, it was easy for him to see where two remedies might be similar to each other. And then the other source was his extensive clinical experience that he put in, you know, when a remedy seems indicated and it doesn't act, and then another remedy does act. This is... You know, these are remedies that I can readily confuse with each other. And if Benninghausen could readily confuse one remedy for another, they must be quite similar. You know, if I were to publish my list of remedies I've confused one for another, it would be it would be a travesty. You know, it would be. But I have very confusing remedies one for another. Are you still there?
Hey, I'm here.
Okay, I hit a funny button on my phone, I guess.
No problem.
So these are divided down into logical sections. For example, you might look under the concordances for Pulsatilla, and there's a section on mind. And in there are the remedies that are similar to Pulsatilla in their mind, mental and emotional symptoms. And then there's another section in skin, and these are the remedies that have similar skin symptoms to Pulsatilla. and so on. And so there are a variety of ways that you can use these concordances. Use them just like rubrics in an analysis. And one way might be this. You let's say you have a case that has responded to pulsatilla, but not completely. Okay, so you've seen some improvement in the case, but it was only partial improvement, and now there are some new symptoms that come out. And you say, well, I'm concluding from this that this was a kind of closicum, wasn't the similimum, a kind of closicum that moved the case forward. There's been improvement, but there's been a shift in development of some new symptoms, so it wasn't the similimum with a capital S and three L's. So I need a buddy to come in, and I need another remedy to come in and follow this one. And so we look at it and say, well, okay, what has improved? The mental emotional symptoms are improved, the skin symptoms are improved, but the modalities, some new symptoms, but the modalities are the same as pulsatilla. So we look at the concordance and we find pulsatilla, conditions of aggravation and amelioration, and that rubric lists those remedies that have similar modalities to pulsatilla. And so we take that rubric and we add it to our analysis, as well as adding the new symptoms that have come up in the case. And that will home us in, and it'll help us define those remedies that are likely to be following.
Hmm.
So it's really useful this way, you know, for a second prescription. And in fact, Kent, in his wonderful lecture on the second prescription, throws in, you know, he's pretty critical of Benninghausen in many respects, but he throws in this little piece. He says, in giving the second prescription, those who are not familiar with the concordances of Benninghausen are lost, or something like this.
Mm.
Okay, so he really emphasized the importance of these. The other place that I find it useful is if I'm about to give a remedy, but I'm not clear. You know, I'm sitting here with a 70% confidence level in my remedy. I'll often run to the concordances and look and say, well, what remedies did Benninghausen can often confuse with pulsatilla? Okay, and I'll look in there and I'll say, you know, maybe I should, let's just throw in, you know, the mental emotional symptoms of this case look really pulsatilla-ish. And so I'm going to add to my analysis this rubric of remedies that can resemble pulsatilla in the mental emotional realm. And maybe I'll even restrict to that rubric and only look at the remedies that are in there. Mm. And I'll say, okay, what else shows up? You know, is there anything else here that might be interesting? And sometimes this has given me a smaller remedy that I wouldn't otherwise have given, that can look a lot like the, quote, more obvious remedy that was showing up in my analysis. So I think these are really helpful. It's worth really spending some time in looking at the divisions, the different categories that he has for defining similarity. We find other lists of similar remedies and remedies that follow well, but Benninghausen is really the only one who said it follows well in this respect.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I didn't see Sheila Creasy do something. She's the only person I've ever seen do something similar to what Benninghausen does.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen her work?
Sheila? A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, because she has I didn't know if it was really different, but it seemed to me like there was a lot of similarity in terms of she would really relate the remedies in terms of exactly which symptoms they shared as opposed to just the fact that they were related to each other.
Exactly. And, of course, as you become a very accomplished practitioner, then you might outgrow Benninghausen's concordances because you develop the ability to do this comparison and contrast, you know, from your own knowledge base, perhaps, as she has. But
right.
But in the meanwhile, this is a great place to start. It's also a wonderful tool for self-study to look down there and say that he says pulsatilla and lachesis. You know, lachesis is a remedy that could look like pulsatilla in these respects. And you go, whoa, would I expect to confuse pulsatilla and lachesis?
Mm.
So it's a nice place to go in and say, okay, let's study those two remedies side by side with respect to this similarity that he's talking about. And it's just a really nice exercise to start stretching our knowledge of materia medica.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I know I love this approach, personally, and I really like the idea because I know that second and third prescriptions are so difficult. You know, it's so much harder than the first prescription.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And but I know one of the concerns, and it's certainly been a concern of mine, is just the limited number of remedies in a therapeutic pocketbook. And I know, as you know, there's only 125 remedies, and you know, not only are the new remedies missing, but even some more of our, you know, our stalwarts like Jalcimium and Calibicromicum aren't in there. So
yeah.
how do you deal with that situation in terms of, you know, remedies that we would normally use on a regular basis not being contained in that database?
Yeah. Well, this is a potential problem. Then again, 125 remedies. You know, I think some of the Benninghausenites defend this, saying, well, 125 remedies seem to work for Benninghausen. 100 seem to work for Hahnemann. In fact, for much of Hahnemann's lifetime, 30 seemed to work okay, you know. Yarr wrote that wonderful little piece in his introduction to 40 Years Practice where he talks about how impossible it is to learn the Materia Medica now that there's about 140 remedies. And kind of pines for the day when there are only 60. So, you know, there are folks like Gipser who, you know, these folks are gifted practitioners and very successful in limiting themselves by choice to these 125 remedies. And I think that often they accomplish cures by playing soccer, you know? And, you know, I mean, we listen
you
to people
explain
like,
that a little bit so people understand what you meant by that?
Well, yeah. Well, we hear people like Massimo Mangiliavori saying we should strive for the similimum, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing him, but the idea that we should strive for the one remedy that takes a person completely to cure, single remedy. And there's a nice ethic there. But then again, what's wrong with curing somebody with three successive prescriptions? You know, there was a wonderful Pennsylvania Society of Homeopathic Medicine back 1860-something. I was a pretty young practitioner at the time. someone presented a case of premenstrual syndrome that was cured by APIS. And one of the attendees of the conference asked, what would you have done if you had seen this case 3 years ago? Because Herring only recently introduced APIS as a remedy to us, and you wouldn't have had it. And there was a little discussion, and finally Lippe stood up. This is recorded in the journal, so, you know, we can read it. Lippe stood up and said, oh, well, he said, I think first you would have given Lachesis, and then maybe Pulsatilla, and then Sulfur, and you would have cured her in 6 months instead of two. And you know, how much of our practice is like that anyway? You know, I mean, we might strive for the one remedy. You might strive for the whole in one that takes somebody to cure. But, you know, how often can we really find that? Maybe that remedy just went extinct in the rainforest of Nicaragua. And so we so often accomplish cures by successive prescriptions. And I think that with 125 remedies under your belt, if you know them well, and if you know how to use them well, and you know how to use your tools, maybe you're as likely to cure somebody as if you had 120, you know, 1,200 remedies, okay, or 2,100 remedies, and didn't know your tools as well. I mean, that's one answer to this question, and it's what the more biblical Benninghausenites will tell you, those who kind of follow scriptural literalism of this approach. The other approach is to say, well, it's a damn shame that Benninghausen died, and we all agree with that. And Timothy Allen, in his edition of the Therapeutic Bacchus book, did add some remedies. I think he might have added about a dozen. I think there might be, is it 136 or something in there? So Allen added some. Now, there's a lot of criticism of that. You know, Gipser in Germany is aghast with that and says, don't use Allen for that purpose. It's inaccurate. But, I mean, who knew his Materia Medica better than Timothy Allen, you know, so I trust his additions. But I think there's this process that needs to go on today of cautiously and annotating the additions, adding remedies to Benninghausen's repertory. I think we've got the vehicle and radar to do this now because they could be added and labeled with the addition. So, you know, you could choose to strip back and only use the 125 remedies of Benninghausen. Or you could choose to trust the additions of any of a number of other authors to this work and start adding some of the valuable remedies that we'd hate to do. I'd hate to do without Jalcimium in a flu epidemic, you know.
For sure.
So it just brought me back from from a near-death experience. I was down on the couch this last week with a...
Oh, is that the remedy? You sounded like you
needed severe gelsamian.
I spoke to you, yeah.
Viral.
So that's the one that helped, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, it got me in gear. So, you know, we've got wonderful challenges in front of us in building up our literature in this way. So.
Very, very interesting, Will. You know, one of the things that I see a lot in the literature when you're reading about Bunninghausen is this idea, and correct me if I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but Gagin symptoms.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about those? Because, you know, when I read these explanations, it all seems a little ethereal and confusing.
Yeah. This is a concept that we just don't encounter in other approaches, and it's unclear to me where this came into the Bunninghausen approach.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't see records of Bunninghausen himself having used it,
mm-hmm.
but the contemporary Bunninghausenites are and attribute it to him. A lot of this literature is in German, and I read that very, very slowly, if at all. So perhaps we can dig it out of the historical literature. But Gagin in German means against or opposed. So these are Gegensymptomen, or against or opposing symptoms. And the way he uses them is this. Let's say you build up a repertorization, and there's a very important modality in it. And let's say that modality is that he's better with let's just make it very general. He's better with heat, okay? And that's it's important that this be a central symptom in the case. It's not just an aside. It has to be one of the most important aspects of the case. And it's usually a modality, okay? And then he would pull in as a Gagin symptom the opposite of that. And he'd say, okay, let's put, and, you know, you have to decide what's the opposite of better with heat. Is it worse with heat or is it better with cold? Okay. So, you know, sometimes you have to be a little cautious which you choose. And he pulls that in with a negative value in the analysis. And here's how it is that the way the Gagin symptom is weighted in the analysis is it's subtracted from the positive symptom. So let's say that, let's just make a really strange hypothetical thing. Your two leading remedies are arsenicum and pulsatilla, okay? And I think they're both in there for better with heat. But what we'll find with arsenicum is it's a 3 in better with heat. And it's maybe it's not even listed in worse with heat, okay? I'm not sure if this is true or not, but I'm making this up. And then pulsatilla comes up second in your analysis, and maybe it's got a 1, grade 1 for better with heat, but it's a grade 4 for worse with heat, okay? And so the composite score for that modality is a -3 for pulsatilla and a +3 for arsenicum. And this would cinch the choice of arsenicum over pulsatilla in this case. Am I making sense?
Yeah, very interesting.
So in other words, this Gagin symptom, in order for the remedy to come up with favor in the analysis, the Gagin symptom has to be weighted lower than the positive symptom that it opposes. You know, we usually don't use negative symptomatology in homeopathy.
Right.
This is the one example of that I'm familiar with. And it's kind of handy. I've actually used it on a number of occasions and found it to be a useful thing.
You've actually had some success using it, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Will, you know, we've been talking a little bit about the Bunninghausen Therapeutic Pocketbook today, and I know there's different translations out there. There's you mentioned
mm-hmm.
earlier the Timothy Field Allen translation, the
mm-hmm.
George Dimitriadis, and there's also the one that's in Radar, Peter Vince translation.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, as you mentioned before, the Bunninghausen rubrics have been integrated into Synthesis 9, and also Roger Van Zandvoort has come out with the Complete Universale, which is
right.
his version of the Bunninghausen approach
right.
to the complete repertory.
Right.
What is your? Have you? Which ones of these books are you using? Do you have recommendations? I
mean, okay.
Just, all honesty, you know.
Yeah.
What is your personal experience?
I had used for a long time Timothy Allen's version of the therapeutic pocketbook. And I think it's good. You know, it's really cheap.
It is cheap. It's published by Jane, of course.
Yeah. And I think it's reasonably good. There are, now that I have seen revised translations, there are some minor errors in it and typos, but they're minor and they're not going to get you into too much trouble here and there.
And the extra remedies, do you find that a problem? You don't find that a problem.
What's that? No, the
extra remedies in the T.F. Allen translation.
The remedies?
Yeah, the extra remedies.
The extra remedies? No, because I think Allen was pretty astute. I think if we want to make a short list of people who knew the Materia Medica up to one side and down the other, he'd be on it.
Sure.
So I'll trust Timothy Allen's editions.
Mm. Okay.
Way beyond anybody, you know, beyond most people.
Sure.
So I don't see that as a problem. I think that those who are purists and wish to only practice as Bettinghausen approach, that they have this objection. Demetriades's English translation, The Therapeutic Pocketbook, is very good. It's very expensive, but it's a very nice piece of work, and if you want to use it in paper, that's probably the best way to go for a paper translation. If you speak German, then Gipser's version is excellent.
I like the notes for the Demetriades one, by the way, at the end.
Yeah.
Those are really useful.
Yeah, very, very, very good.
Yeah.
Very good. And, you know, if you're going to really put some time into it, it's an expensive book, but, you know, these are tools.
Sure.
The translation of The Therapeutic Pocketbook by Peter Vint that's in Radar is just superb. And for those of you who have not met Peter, again, we can start chuckling. Peter's a lovely man. Peter, you have to meet him to understand how incredibly obsessive Peter is about the subtleties of meaning of a word. I've had dinner with Peter where we managed to cover three words in the course of an entire evening of dinner. Peter's library covers an entire wall. His library is bigger than that. His dictionaries that he uses to translate from cover an entire wall.
He translated Clark's dictionary from English into German, I believe.
He did. He's got German dictionaries from 1834, 1836,
wow.
1838. You know, it's incredible. He's incredibly obsessive, and he put so much care and effort into this translation. Mm. So I would consider it my gold standard at this point. I really love what he's done with it.
Mm.
So currently when I use The Therapeutic Pocketbook, I'm using it within Radar.
Mm.
And there are two ways to do that. There's a brand new Bettinghausen module out, and I have to admit that I'm not very familiar with it yet. I designed it 3 years ago.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and now it's finally out, and really haven't had a chance to test fly it yet. It's really nice to see it there. But typically, I'll just use it as an open repertory and analyze in my standard fashion using it. The Bettinghausen module gives you some wizards that walk you through the process and help to guide the analysis, and it looks pretty nice.
Well, a little bit that I play with it has been, I find it really easy to use, and it seems to make that approach just very, you know, very accessible to people.
Yeah. I designed, or at least gave them the drafts of it, and it looks pretty much like what they incorporated while riding trains through Austria after that Graz Liga conference. So it was a very inspired, you know, riding through Austria on these trains through the Alps and writing it on my laptop, and it was a very inspired piece of work, you know, with all of this stuff around me, and staying in a little hotel in Innsbruck that played Mozart and,
oh, wow.
And you know, on the intercom. And so, you know, I thought it felt like, you know, it was a good place to try to channel Bettinghausen's spirit. So that's principally what I use now, is the therapeutic pocketbook within Radar.
So I see that we're running short on time, so I just thought, you know, for people who want to do some more investigation into Bettinghausen and his approach, What could you recommend as references or resources?
Yeah. Well, I'd start out getting...
Will, are you still there? Okay, well, unfortunately, we seem to have lost our guest speaker for the evening, probably some type of difficulty with his telephone line. Let me just say that Dr. Taylor and myself will be conducting a seminar, a three-day seminar, in Northern California, in Arcata, California, which is a beautiful part of the state, up in the Redwoods and right near the ocean. And we're going to be doing a three-day seminar called Mastering Radar NEH in Your Practice. And this is the first time ever that we've offered something like this. It's a really hands-on, practical training where you basically will not just learn homeopathy, but actually how to integrate a software tool like Radar in your practice to solve difficult cases. We'll go through different analysis strategies, why you would use one strategy over another in any particular case, and then literally how to apply Radar and Encyclopedia Homeopathica to the solution that particular case. Will, are you back?
Back. I'm sorry, my phone battery just died.
Oh, no, no problem. I was just letting them know a little bit about the training in Arcata that's coming up, and I was just telling them basically this is a first-time training for us in terms of integrating the teaching of homeopathy and homeopathic software at the same time. Is there anything that you wanted to say about that training before we end up finished up the call? Will? Okay, I lost Will again, or he's extremely shy, one or the other. anyway, that seminar is going to be happening August 27th through the 29th, and if you need more information, you can go to our website and look under on our Radar Homeopathic Software Training Calendar under that date, and you'll find the information. You can also, if you want to get more information, you can call Kate Clark at 707-444-8483. That's 707-444-8483. It will be a really amazing, amazing class. So I want to thank
you. I'm back again.
Are you back, Will?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No,
I don't know what happened there.
Okay, so Will, I was just telling you about the Arcata event. Do you want to say anything about that before we finish up the call?
Oh, no, except it is so fun to work together with you, Kim, back and forth. Those of you who haven't seen Kim and I in action together, we get into a little bit of a Laurel and Hardy style improvisation, and it's always just a hoot. So,
am I Laurel or Hardy, Will?
Please be there. I'm not sure which one is who. maybe we trade that role back and forth sometimes. Maybe.
So, Will, I just want to ask you the last question.
Sure.
For people who want to find out more about the Bunninghausen approach, are there specific resources that you would recommend or places they can go to find out more information?
Yeah, I would definitely start with reading the A Contribution to the Characterizing Value of Symptoms essay by Bunninghausen, which is in his lesser writings.
Hmm.
That's just a really important place to start. And then Desai's book, D-E-S-A-I, which is How to Find the Similimum Using the Bossier-Bunninghausen Repertory. But everything is applicable to the therapeutic pocketbook as well. Those are probably the two best approaches. The other is in Tim Pink's translation of the therapeutic pocketbook, there's a nice discussion, a nice description of use. And even if you don't use that particular repertory, you know, version, the description of how to use it is worth the price of the book, which is very inexpensive. So those are probably the best places to start. There's also in Demetriades' translation, there's a lot of good information in Demetriades' therapeutic pocketbook. A lot of good stuff. There's also quite a bit of good stuff on the Whole Health Now website. And I think if you just do, you know, go to the What's New page and click the search button and for Bunninghausen, you'll see quite a bit there that's really worthwhile reading. Some of it very practical about use and some of it more about the constructions of the repertory that is good background material.
Also, your article series, Taking the Case, Will, has quite a bit of information.
Yeah, that's right. I think I do have a couple of pieces on that.
Yeah.
The other piece is the article I have in that article series on the characterizing dimensions of a mental-emotional symptom.
Mm.
Because one of the things that's in me is how do we take this next step that Benninghausen didn't and incorporate the mental-emotional symptomatology into his approach. And that's one of my big fascinations.
Well, fantastic. I mean, as always, you just did an amazing job of communicating an immense amount of information in a very intelligible and understandable way. So I really want to thank you again. And I just want to reiterate, for people who want more information about seeing Dr. Taylor in beautiful Northern California, up in the Redwoods and hiking through the mountains and the ocean, please give us a call, 707-444-8483. Will, thank you again for
very good.
I really appreciate it. I'm going to unmute the line for whoever who's on the call and wants to say thank you. I'll let them do that now.